start today by talking about something we led up to last time, which is the question of why extra and missing X chromosomes are no big deal, but missing and X autosomes are. And this actually was discovered from looking at the pattern of inheritance of coat color in cats. And I am not going to stop to show you one, but when you get back to your computer, not the one you have now, you can Google images for either calico cats or tortoiseshell cats, and you'll see what we're talking about. It turns out that male cats are either black or orange. But female cats, in addition to being black or orange, can also be a kind of mottled color, or patches of black and patches of orange. And this patchy pattern is called tortoiseshell. Now, a calico cat is a cat which is tortoiseshell but has white patches on top. Male cats can be black with white or orange with white, but only female cats are both black and orange and white. And the three-color cat is called a calico, for you cat fanciers. Now, what Mary Lyon, who discovered this, and therefore it's sometimes called the Lyon hypothesis instead of the inactive X hypothesis, she realized that the gene which controls black or orange is on the X. So that means that a male who has one X and one Y, or chromosomes that look like this, has only one allele of the black-orange coat color allele gene. So the coat color gene is present only once in a male. So let's say it's a black cat, male cat. This would be the black allele. But if it's an orange male cat, this would be the orange allele. Now, what about a black female cat? Well, a female cat has two X's. So one possibility is that the cat has two black alleles. And this is called homozygous black. The cat is said to be homozygous, or the organism is said to be a homozygote. Now, is there any kind of other kind of homozygous that's possible? You could be homozygous orange if you're a female cat. You could have two copies of orange. Now, both of these states are homozygous, but one is homozygous orange and one is homozygous black. Is there any other possibility? Well, you could have one of each, in which case the cat's genotype is heterozygous. Now, a male can't be heterozygous because a male has only one copy of the X. Now, what Mary Lyon realized was that all the tortoiseshell cats had this genotype. And the explanation is that in any patch of fur, either this X was working and that patch was orange, or this X was working and that patch was black. So the idea is that a female who is heterozygous is mosaic. That in about half of her cells, her father's X is working and her mother's X is not. And in the other half of the cells, it's the other way around. Now, what happens in a cat is that, and also in your skin, is that because of the way development works, a single cell produces, multiplies by mitosis, and this entire patch are the descendants of a single cell. But this patch is descendants of a different cell. So these two patches can have different X's on. And the way this is thought to work is that in the egg and the sperm and in the zygote, both X's are on. And then you make an embryo when the embryo has a few hundred cells, in each of these cells there is an independent event, and one X is turned off or inactivated. And thereafter, and it's random which X is turned off. So in this cell, it could be that the one that's turned off is the orange one, but in this one, the X that's turned off is the black one. Now, by inactive, we mean that it's not transcribed. Almost the entire X is not transcribed. Is it replicated? Well, every descendant of this cell, by mitosis, gets two X's. So both X's are replicated, but only one is transcribed. That's the so-called active X. So all the cells that come from here have the X with black on, and if they're skin cells, that patch of cell of skin will be black. Now, there's a correlate to this. If you actually look at a female cell during interphase, what do you expect to see? Chromosomes? During interphase, what happens to the chromosomes? They stretch out. So you don't expect to see any individual chromosomes. Each chromosome is relatively unwound and stretched out. You see instead what is called chromatin. But in female cells, but not in males, in some tissues of the body, you can actually see a sort of dark staining lump, which is named a bar body after its discoverer. Now, males don't have bar bodies. And males have only one X. Females have bar bodies, and they have two X's. So it's pretty clear now that what the bar body is the inactive X. So after mitosis, the other X stretches out, all the other chromosomes stretch out, and are accessible for transcription. But the inactive X remains tightly coiled. And since it's tightly coiled, the RNA polymerase can't get to it, and it can't be transcribed. Now clearly at one point it has to open up enough to be replicated. But through most of interphase, it is tight and a bar body. Okay. So I have a question for you. Is it possible to have a female with no bar bodies or a male with one? So why don't you discuss that for about 30 seconds and then we'll see if we can figure out how this is possible, if this is possible, and if so, how. Female with no bar body. Do I have a volunteer? Well, I see my usual customers, but okay.
A female, that's an XO. It has only one X, which has no bar body.
So an XO, meaning a Turner's with only one X, has only one X. That X works. And so there's no bar body. Now, what about a male with one? Well, to have a bar body, you got to have what? It would have to be two X's, and to be a male, you'd have to have a Y. Now, there are calico and tortoiseshell cats are virtually always female. There's actually a woman who had a cat. It was tortoiseshell or calico, I don't remember which, and it was a male. And she was so surprised by this, she researched it and wrote a book about it. What was with the cat? The hint is the cat was sterile. Male tortoiseshell. It was one of these. It was a Klinefelter's cat. So, This is how our bodies were discovered from looking at the inheritance of coat color in cats, but in fact, we now know that it affects many other genes and traits as well. But in most cases, what happens is that the descendants of this cell and the descendants of this cell get mixed up. And so you don't get patches where clearly one X is on and clearly one X is off. But in some tissues you do. So the real next question that I want to ask about is, how is all this inherited? If cats are crossed, as many breeders do, how will these coat color patterns, or in fact any trait or property, be inherited? So that's sort of issue one. But there's another major issue for today. Even if we understand how these genes or chromosomes are inherited, how is it that phenotype of a particular kind, genotype determines phenotype? Why does having an O allele make you orange and a black allele make you black? What is the relationship between genotype and phenotype? How does any particular genome give a particular phenotype? So we're going to discuss this today first for coat color, and then we're going to do it for other genes that are not necessarily on the X. So before I do that, let me ask if there are any questions about this inactive X business before we move on. Okay, so in that case, let's give it a try. Let's try some inheritance. Now, it turns out that the steps for following the inheritance of a particular set of genes is the same, whether the genes are on the X, whether the genes are on autosome, etc. It doesn't make any difference. The basic procedure is the same. So I'm going to go through it fairly carefully, and to help you, you need handout 21A. The basic idea first is you have to figure out the genotype or the alleles of the parents. So let's pick an example. Suppose we cross tortoiseshell female and an orange male. So the first thing you have to do is set up the alleles and chromosomes of the parents. So what does a tortoiseshell female look like? So if you look at your handout, we've drawn the two X's. Now I haven't drawn the cell, but of course this is in a single cell. This is the adult, not the gametes. First you have to figure out what the adult parents are, and then you figure out what gametes they would make, and then you put the gametes together to make zygotes. So the first step is to get the parents. So what's the genotype of a tortoiseshell? Homozygous? Heterozygous? What is it? Has to be heterozygous. So we have to put O in black. Now what about an orange male? The chromosomes are actually drawn on your handout, an X and a Y. The big one here is the X, two in the female, and this is a Y. But I think it's clearer if you draw it as a line than if you draw it as an X. If you draw it as an X, you get mixed up between chromatids and chromosomes. So if it's orange, there's only one allele, and that had better be orange. Now, just to remind you, what does one of these lines represent? It's a chromosome, right? So is it single-stranded DNA or double-stranded? It's actually double-stranded. But the first step before we can do any meiosis is what? We have to double the DNA and interphase before we can do anything. So you notice that the first step written on your handout is you double the DNA, and the only thing we have to do is draw the cell in, which I didn't bother to do. So if you double the DNA, well, what about these two copies here? Just to remind you, what are sisters here, and what are homologs? So let's say these two. What are they? Those are homologs, not sister chromatids. On the other hand, these two are sister chromatids, and they're going to be identical. Now, what happens now if we go through meiosis? The reason we went through meiosis in some detail is so we would be able to predict what gametes you would get out of this. So let's consider, I'm going to start back up here because there isn't room. Here's the female, here's the male. At the end of first division, what are you going to have? Well, what separates in first division? Sisters or homologs? If you don't know, you better find out, at least by the final, not by Thursday. So the sisters are what separate at first division, and the, I know I said it wrong, the homologs separate at first division, and the sisters separate at second. So at first division for the female, as shown in your handout, these two are going to separate, although we didn't draw the cells. And for the male, the doubled X and the doubled Y are going to separate. And now at second division, so this is first division, and then comes second. So first we do the parents, and then we do meiosis. And we've drawn out first and second division separately to make it a little clearer. So now if the sisters separate, each of these two sisters ends up in its own gamete, and each of these two ends up in its own gamete, and that's what you get from the female. Every female gets, gamete gets one X. But what's with the alleles? They're not drawn on your handout. What's with the O's and the B's? Well, we know, what's here? Must be O's. So they'd be O's. So we separate them. Two of the daughter of the four possible results of gamete, of meiosis, two of the X's carry the O allele, and by the same argument, two of them carry the black allele. Now, what happens with the male? Well, the two sister chromatids of the X separate, and the two sister chromatids of the Y separate. But in the Y-bearing gamete, there's no allele of the black, of the coat color gene. But what about the gametes with the X? They have to have an O. As we go back here, this had an O. So when it doubles, they each have an O. The two separate. And now we have, as a result of meiosis, we have the gametes. Now, we have the gametes of our cats, but do we ever see the gametes of our cats? What are we interested in? We're interested in the kittens, the next generation of cats. So how do you get them? Well, the male gametes have to meet the female gametes. So now we have to figure out if many of the female ones meet many of the male ones, what will we get? What combinations and in what proportions? And there are many ways to figure this out, but one of the most classic ways, which you probably all know about, is to make what is called a Punnett square. And this is just a simple way of keeping track of the gametes and their combinations. You don't have to do it this way, but this is one. So you put the gametes, the different kinds of gametes of one parent on one side and the other parent on the other. Now, there are four gametes here. But you don't have to write all four, because there are two kinds in equal proportions. So all I have to write over here, and this is in the right-hand corner of your handout, actually I wrote the female on the top, and I wrote the male on the side. So the female either contributes an X with an O or an X with a black on it. Two kinds, equal proportions. What does the male kick in? Well, again, there are four gametes, but there's only two kinds in equal proportions, with a Y or with an X with an O on it. So that's written on the left here. Now, by filling in the squares, it just tells you what can meet what. So two X's can meet each other, and they both have O's. Two X's can meet each other, but in this case, one has O and one has black. Or an X can meet from the mother can meet a Y. So what are you going to get? Now, this does not mean if you get four offspring, they will be this four. It means if you have many offspring, you will expect these four kinds, and since they each appear once, in equal proportions. Or, if you have many offspring, what's the chance of getting one with this genotype? One in four. But that does not mean if you have four offspring, you'll get one of them. But it means if you have many offspring, it tells you the proportion should be 1:1:1:1. Well, is this genotype or phenotype? This is just genotype. And we're really interested in phenotype. Well, it's pretty easy in this case, because what you see is what you get. First of all, do we know from sex here? Well, get two X's, you're a female. Get an X and a Y, you're a male. We know that part. Now, what about coat color? Well, what's this one going to be? Orange female. This is one that's going to be tortoiseshell. Male and black male. There's no issue here of dominance or complications. What you see is what you get. So in fact, that's what we're going to get. The females are going to be half orange and half tortoiseshell, and the males are going to be half orange and half black. Now, let's to be sure that everybody's got it. Let's you try one. Rather than asking you to predict the results, I'm going to ask you the other way. Let's suppose you do a cross with two cats, or two of your cats run off at night and take care of it. Anyway, two cats mate, and the result is that all the female kittens are tortoiseshell. And that's all you know. So I have a question for you. What could the mother be? Could the female mother cat be black, orange, or tortoiseshell? So give that a shot and check your, either discuss it with your neighbor or check it with your neighbor when you've done it. What of these is possible? We didn't tell you what the males were. On purpose, I might add.
No, I mean like the male
How many people think they know the answers? I'd say about half of you. Are there any questions about this before I go any further? All right, so let's take a vote. And let's not cheat this time. So let's say close your eyes for just a second. How many people think the mother could be black? Okay, orange. Tortoise shell. Okay, you can open your eyes. So a lot thought the mother could be black. I think even more thought the mother could be orange, but a lot. And a few people thought the mother could be tortoise shell. Now, let's step back a minute. All the female kittens are tortoise shell. So what is their genotype? It's this, right? So what does that mean? They got one X from one parent and one X from the other. Now, if there were a lot of kittens and they're all tortoise shell, this means that one parent had to kick in an orange and one parent had to kick in a black. So what is the most likely genotype for the parents? Could the parents be heterozygous? Doesn't look good. So if the parent were heterozygous, that is, the mom, then the mom wouldn't give every daughter cat the same chromosome. So this implies that one parent is giving only X's with black, and one parent is giving only X's with orange. Which parent was which? Now, most of you said you don't know, because, in fact, the mother could be either one. So how would you know the difference? What did you have to look at? You have to look at the male kittens to know, because where does the male kitten get his X from? He gets it from his mom only. And so that's way you can figure out, if you wanted to know, what the mom was. Okay. So we'll leave this cross now and consider, before we go on, this issue not just of how does the inheritance work, but how does genotype determine phenotype? Now, this case is interesting because it turns out to be an example of a pretty common situation. It turns out that virtually all cats make black pigment. But what they do with it determines whether they look black or they look orange. Apparently, some other protein affects... The pigment is not itself a protein. Some other protein affects how the pigment is distributed. And that determines whether the cat's fur appears to be black or orange. So there's some gene, and I'm going to call it gene C for the coat color gene. And this gene has two alleles, we already know. It has the O allele and the black allele. And we know that gene C makes enzyme C. And enzyme C, or protein C, is responsible for turning the black pigment into orange. It probably doesn't turn the actual pigment, but changes the distribution so it appears orange. Now, what we're saying is, if you have enzyme C in that patch of fur, that patch of fur will appear orange. What happens if you don't have any enzyme C? That means this step is blocked, and that patch of fur appears black. So, the implication then is, what do these alleles do? Well, they're both versions of the gene that codes for enzyme C. But one of them codes for a working enzyme C, and one does not. Which one codes for a version of enzyme C that works? Let's vote. Orange? Black? Chicken? Okay, well, the answer is right. It's orange. But since everybody didn't vote for orange, I know some of you were either undecided or didn't want to vote for black, or it's too early in the morning, as we always say. So the point here, though, is that it's orange. Because if you have the orange allele, you make good enzyme and you carry out the conversion and the cat is orange, or that patch of fur is orange. If you have the black allele, you make inactive enzyme or no enzyme, reaction is blocked, and the cat's, that part of fur, is black. Now, this turns out to be a fairly common state of affairs, that one allele of the gene is read out to make you enzyme that works. And one allele of the gene has some kind of change in it, and you get either no enzyme or no enzyme that works. Either the enzyme is so messed up it can't carry out its function, or it isn't there at all. But the result is catalysis versus non-catalysis, or function versus no function. And that's a pretty common state of affairs. So now that we've seen this, we've looked at sort of both parts for the black-orange situation, both, and the one thing we didn't write down here is when you do, we've looked at inheritance and we've looked at genotype determining phenotype. And now I want to consider, how does this work for genes on an autosome? How does the inheritance business work? And how does the genotype determining phenotype work? So let's pick a different example, and one of these is also written on your handout. Instead of doing black and orange fur color, let's do blue versus brown eyes. Now, eye color is actually determined or affected by the effects of many different genes. But if all the other genes are held constant, then variation in this one gene determines blue versus brown. So we'll assume we can ignore everything else and just worry about this one gene. So suppose a blue-eyed person, well, what's the genotype of a blue-eyed person? Let's say homozygous blue, okay? Let's suppose we have a homozygous blue-eyed person and a homozygous brown-eyed person, and they get it together and have a kid. Now, I don't think we need to go through the whole shebang. What do the kids get? Obviously, they get one copy of the chromosome with blue and one with brown, and they're heterozygous. That part is pretty obvious. But now, what happens if two such heterozygotes get it together and have a child? What happens then? And so that's what's written on your handout here. But we've only written one parent. Now, of course, your parents are, and that's, you want to get it right, both heterozygotes. But when it comes to figuring out gametes this time, do we have to treat the two parents separately? This time, the setup in the two parents is the same, since we're doing autosomes and not X versus Y. And so if we figure out what gametes this parent makes, it'll be the same for the other one. So we only have to do the trick once. So the same routine happens again. You have to double the DNA. Remember, this is a single cell, and the DNA is doubled during interphase. And then we have first division, separating homologs. And then we have second division, separating sisters. And we get all done, what's with the blue and the brown alleles? Well, when we double the DNA here, do we have the same alleles on both sides? Why not? You. You're saying, what about here? Are these the same? Yes. My chalk was in the wrong place. So these would both, the two sisters of this one chromosome, the two sister chromatids have the same allele, and the two sister chromatids of this one have the same allele. Now, we are ignoring crossing over here, because when you're only thinking about one gene at a time, it doesn't make any difference. We're going to end up with the same proportions, whether there was crossing over or not. But when we start worrying about two genes at a time, then we have to take it into account. But at this point, we don't. So now, at second division, the copies of the blue separate from the copies of the brown. And at first division, the two blues separate, second division, the two blues separate from each other, and the two browns. So the point of this whole song and dance is when you get finished with gametes, how many kinds And in what proportions? How many kinds? Two. What proportions? 1-to-1, even Steven. So now, the other parent would do the same thing. And now we have to figure out, if many gametes from this parent meant many gametes from the other parent, what would we get? And this is the step that I forgot to write down last time. You have to figure out the zygotes. So if we put the gametes together, again, we can use a Punnett square. And this is written on your right. But you notice I left out the chromosomes. Now, why did I leave off the chromosomes? In the previous case, whether the allele or the gene was on an X or a Y made a difference. But here it doesn't make any difference. That this parent contributes autosomes, this parent contributes a copy of the same autosome, it doesn't make any difference. So for this discussion, at least, I don't have to draw in the chromosomes. I could. Might make it easier to remember and understand, but I don't need to. But what is important is that blue can meet blue to get homozygous blue. Brown can meet brown to give you homozygous brown. And brown can meet blue to make you a heterozygote. Or blue can make brown to make a heterozygote. Now, how many different genotypes do I have this time? Last time I had 4 different genotypes. How many different ones do I have this time? 2, 1, or 3? I have 3 because I have the 2 homozygotes and I have the 2, 1. Both of these heterozygotes are the same. Whether I write blue-brown or brown-blue doesn't make any difference. Whether I got the blue from my dad and the brown from my mom or vice versa, it doesn't matter. Because there is no inactivation of autosomes. There is an activation of X chromosomes, but not of autosomes. So, in terms of genotype then, what am I going to get? I'm going to get homozygous blue to heterozygous to homozygous brown. In what proportions? If there were many offspring, I would expect 1-to-2-to-1, or 1/4, 1/2, 1/4. Now, to remind you again, this does not mean if you have 4 children that one of them will have be homozygous blue. It means that if you look at many offspring of such marriages, approximately 1/4 will be homozygous blue. Yeah?
Well, back in the cat problem, you asked which could it be, but could, even though it's like probably, not likely, couldn't the mom have been tortoiseshell? Like, because we're talking about probabilities and not actual... You know, like, just because...
Okay, she's asked a very interesting question, which is, if you're asked what is likely, do you bring up non-disjunction? To which the answer is no. Okay, so what we're saying is in the absence of non-disjunction and funny business in the previous case, could the mother have been tortoiseshell? And the answer is no. But I don't think even if there was quote-unquote funny business, she could have been tortoiseshell. Because if we're saying if you have many, many offspring and all of the females are tortoiseshell, then you have to assume the parents were pure.
But why couldn't she have just donated that one to all of her daughters?
What is the chance that a tortoiseshell with many daughters will give always the same chromosome? And the answer is that's vanishingly small, so we're ignoring it. The point that you make, which is, in many of these cases, the answer is, it's almost always this way, but there is a dim possibility it could be that way. Doesn't mean that you go for the dim possibility. Okay? I've told many of you this story before, but there is a very famous saying in medical school, when you see hoofbeats in Central Park, you don't think of zebras. Could it be a zebra? Yes. Escape from the zoo? Yes. Is it likely to be a zebra? No. And you have to go for the horse first. Okay. All right, to come back to our example here, though. Okay, we know it's going to be 1 to 2 to 1 genotypes, but the final phrase here is you have to put in, the zygotes give you the genotypes. What are the phenotypes? In the case of the cats, the genotype tells you what the phenotype is, and there's no problem. But here we don't know. We're pretty sure what color eyes this one has. We're pretty sure what color eyes this one has. What color eyes does this one have? Why is it brown? Because brown is dominant, right? That doesn't help. Why is brown dominant? Well, someone at least said it right. It has to do with the enzymes. It's not that brown is dominant because blue is recessive. That's true. It is customary in a case like this to call the brown allele dominant and the blue allele recessive. Meaning that if both are present at one time, the effects of the brown allele show up and the effects of the blue allele do not. But we're interested here is why does that happen at the enzyme level, like with the orange and the black? It turns out the situation is very similar to orange and black, in that one allele makes working enzyme and one allele does not. So this time it's the eye color gene, so we'll call it gene E, and it has two alleles, blue and brown. But in this case, it makes an enzyme, and the enzyme converts colorless stuff to blue, to brown. So if you have a good copy of the gene, you make the enzyme, and the colorless stuff is turned into brown pigment, and your eyes appear brown. Now, what happens if you can't make this enzyme? You don't make any brown pigment, right? So you'd think your eyes would be colorless. But in fact, if there's no brown pigment, your eyes appear blue. And they appear blue for the same reason the sky appears blue, and largely why pigeon feathers appear to be blue, because of the differential scattering of different wavelengths of light. It's not because there's blue pigment in blue eyes. It's because blue light is scattered differently. And so, which allele is which? The brown allele makes working enzyme, gets the job done, and you have brown pigment. The blue allele makes no enzyme, and you don't have pigment. Now, why is brown dominant? If you have one brown allele and one blue allele, do you have enzyme? And the answer is yes. And remember that enzyme works over and over again. So even though you only have perhaps half the usual amount of enzyme, you have enough to convert colorless to brown, and your eyes appear to be brown. So another way to say this is that an individual of this genotype, brown blank, has brown eyes. It doesn't matter what the second one is, whether it's brown or whether it's blue. Now, you can use any symbols you want for this stuff, but it is customary when you have a dominant allele and a recessive allele to use an uppercase and a lowercase letter. So to say big B and little b instead of brown and blue. It is also strongly advised that you use different symbols for the alleles or genotypes and the phenotypes. That's another reason for using big B and little b for the genes or the alleles and to use brown and blue for the phenotype, because it's very easy to get them mixed up. Okay. Now, in many cases involving humans and other mammals, the production of a lot of enzymes is and proteins in general is constitutive. That is, it is not regulated. Some are regulated, but many are not. And in the case where they're not regulated, if you have two good copies of the gene, you make two doses of enzyme. And if you have one good copy of the gene, as in a heterozygote, you make only one dose of enzyme. Now, the fact that you make half as much protein in a heterozygote turns out to be very important, because it allows you to detect heterozygotes often relatively easily, because they make half the amount of protein of a homozygote, say brown brown or big B big B. And that allows you to detect heterozygotes or carriers. Now, in the case of eye color, it's not such a big deal. Nobody worries too much about having a little B kid who will have blue eyes. But in many cases, let's say you have a cross, you are worried about having a little A kid. Now, if you're both heterozygotes, you can have a little A kid. But what if you're big A, big A, big A, little A? Can you have a little A kid? And the answer is no. So by testing the parents, you can discover whether they can stop worrying or whether they should keep worrying. If both parents are heterozygotes, then we have to go further. But if one parent is homozygous, we can stop worrying about having a little A child, and we'll discuss some cases of that later. So it's customary often to do carrier testing. And in many cases, you don't have to test the DNA. You can simply test the enzyme or the protein involved and see what level of that protein is made. Okay. Now, we've done brown versus blue eyes, and I want to do the general case. So we have one more case written on your handout, which is actually almost exactly the same as blue-brown. Except the difference is, instead of using blue and brown alleles, I've used A and A star. Now, the reason I've used this symbolism is to imply that these two alleles are different. And in fact, the A star one is meant to be the variant or the mutant allele. And the question is, maybe I should even say variant. And the question is, what are going to be the patterns of inheritance in this case, in the general case? And by using two capital A's, I have avoided the issue of which one is dominant. Because we want to consider cases where big A is dominant and cases where big A star is dominant. So by writing it this way, I haven't prejudiced it. So how would this be inherited? If a trait is controlled by A and A star, what would happen if you crossed two heterozygotes? Now, first you have to get, this is the parents. Then you have to get, they go through meiosis, you get gametes, and you get zygotes. Now, getting gametes from here is almost exactly the same as getting gametes from blue-brown. Except when you're all done, the gametes, instead of being half blue-carrying and half brown-carrying, are going to be half A and half A star. And that's actually worked out for you on the handout, but you should convince yourself, go home and be sure you understand, that if you take this and go through meiosis, that's what you'll get. Half the gametes will be A, and half will be A star. So if that's right, what happens if two of these individuals have offspring? How do you figure out what you expect? You have to make a Punnett square, except instead of using blue and brown, you use A and A star from one parent, A and A star from the other parent, and that in fact is written on the right of your handout again. If one parent gives you half gametes with A and half gametes with A star, and the other parent does the same, then just as before, you can get homozygous for one allele, one quarter of the time, homozygous for the other allele, one quarter of the time, and half the time, or the other two cases, you get heterozygotes. So, just like with blue-brown, if you have any heterozygous gene on an autosome, when you get down to the zygote stage, it's going to be the expected proportions are 1 to 1 to 2, or 1 quarter, 1 quarter, 1 half. But the really interesting question is, what about the phenotypes? So to summarize this, you want to look at the other side of your handout on the bottom, where it says dominance relationships. Now, I realize before I do this, I just ought to say one thing about the terminology. With experimental organisms, usually what you do is you start with two homozygotes. Those are your original parents. And you cross them and you get a heterozygote. And then you cross two heterozygotes and you see what you get next. And what we're looking at is what you get when you cross two heterozygotes. And the standard terminology for that is whatever you started with, which is usually, but not always, homozygous, is the parental generation. And when they are crossed with each other, all the offspring are heterozygous, and this is called the F1, or the first filial generation. And then if you cross two of these with each other to see what happens, that gives you what is called the F2, or the second generation of crossing these offspring. And what we want to look at now is the possibilities for the phenotypes in the F2. We know the genotypes are always the same. 1/4 each homozygote, 1/2 heterozygote. But what are they going to look like? So that's on the bottom. So first it has on your handout the assumption here that A makes the normal peptide, whatever it is. Could be an enzyme, could serve some other function. And A star makes an altered peptide. And if that's the case, what are the phenotypes going to be? And the simplest case is like blue-brown, or like orange-black, in that A works and catalyzes the reaction, and the peptide from A works, and the peptide from A star does not. And as a result, A blank is okay. As long as you have one A allele, you make working protein and you get the job done. And the only individual who has a problem is an A star, who has a block in metabolism. Now, if this is the case, which allele is dominant and which allele is recessive? Well, here we would say the normal allele is dominant, because as long as you have one, it overrides the effect of the mutant allele. And the mutant allele is recessive. And you might write A star here as just little a, and A as A. And only little a has a problem. Now that means there's some kind of block in metabolism, only in little a, there's a block because there isn't any enzyme. And the problem can be either the inability to make Y or the inability to get rid of X. It depends which is the problem. Now, many human diseases that you've heard of work in this fashion. That is, they involve a lack of an enzyme and are recessive. For example, phenylketonuria that we were talking about before is caused by a lack of the enzyme phenylalanine hydroxylase and the inability to convert phenylalanine to tyrosine. So this is blocked in little a, and it's okay in big A blank. Tay-Sachs disease, cystic fibrosis, and many other recessive diseases, galactosemia, are all like this. The homozygous recessive is lacking an enzyme and has a block in metabolism. Now, we know what the pattern of inheritance would be, but what can you do about this? Now, as we've already explained, unless both parents are carriers, you don't worry about the kid anyway. But if the kid is going to have PKU, is going to lack this enzyme, is there anything you can do about it? Now, in some of these cases, there isn't anything you can do about it. But in this particular one, there is. In some cases, by altering the diet, you can get around the problem. In galactosemia, as long as you don't eat galactose, you're okay. This disease, though, what happens is that if you lack the enzyme phenylalanine hydroxylase, then phenylalanine builds up, and so do the byproducts made from it. And they cause mental retardation. So in people with untreated PKU, the average IQ is 53. That's because the compounds derived from phenylalanine interfere with brain development. So what should you do? Just not eat phenylalanine?
Choose the enzyme.
Well, it'd be nice to add the enzyme, but you can't. Okay, you can't add the enzyme because it almost always gets degraded, and if it doesn't, it doesn't get to the right cells. So that doesn't work. And gene therapy would be very nice, but at the moment we haven't figured out how to do it. But if you don't eat phenylalanine, then the bad stuff doesn't build up. And you can't make your own phenylalanine. So what if you don't eat any phenylalanine? You're dead. Phenylalanine is one of the 20 amino acids in protein, and you have to have enough phenylalanine to make protein. The trick is to have enough phenylalanine and none left over. So what you have to eat is a diet in restricted amounts of phenylalanine, so there's just enough and none left over. And in fact, people have figured out what that is and devised special foods for people on this diet. And in the first clinical trial of this diet, the average IQ was 93. And this is an enormous difference. This is the difference between someone who has to be institutionalized and cannot take care of themselves and someone who can lead a normal life. So people who have this condition are identified now at birth, and they eat a special diet, usually through adolescence. Once the brain is fully developed, it's probably not necessary to keep eating this special diet. But if a woman who has this condition gets pregnant, she has to go back on the diet, hopefully before, so that she doesn't poison her fetus. So this is, in fact, one of the great success stories of understanding metabolism and genetic defects and being able to get around it. Now, some of the other cases, there is no way to get around it because, for example, in Tay-Sachs disease, the problem is an enzyme that breaks down a lipid. And that lipid is constantly generated and broken down no matter what you eat. And so in the absence of the enzyme, the undigested lipid just builds up and chokes your nerve cells. And there really isn't anything you can do about that except prevention. So when treatment is not possible, what I mean by prevention is trying to avoid the birth of children who will have this condition. And not everyone has agreed that this is a good idea, but many people think it is. Now, remember we said before that you don't worry about having an AA child, little a, unless you are both carriers. So for many of these conditions, there are testing programs to identify carriers. And if you are both carriers, then you are at risk of having an affected child. And the question is, what can you do about it? And there are ways to test either the fetus or the early embryo to find out either its genotype or its phenotype. And these two were mentioned in last time's notes, but I don't think we got to them. And the most common ways are amniocentesis and what is called PGG for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. It probably should be called PID, but PID is a venereal disease. And so it's called PGD instead. Now, amniocentesis involves taking cells that are shed by the fetus into the fluid or amniotic sac surrounding the fetus. So basically, this gives you a supply of fetal cells, and they can be tested in some cases for enzyme levels, in other cases for DNA status, and you can figure out whether the fetus is going to give rise to a child with a serious condition, and if you wish to, you can do a therapeutic abortion. And one of the troubles with this business is you don't find out until fairly late in pregnancy. Now, people have been trying to push it earlier and earlier, but all the same, you have to have an abortion. And so many people would prefer to do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Now, what this means is that you take eggs from the mom and sperm from the dad, and you do fertilization in vitro in a glass petri dish, and you get an early embryo. And you can, this is, of course, outside a person, but you have an early embryo, and you take one of those cells, and then you test it. You test, usually, its DNA. Now, what the reason this works is that if you remove one cell from an early embryo, the remaining cells, say 7 out of 8, if implanted into a woman, will give you a normal human. You do not get a 7/8 human. You get a complete one. We actually sort of know this from triplets and quintuplets, quintuplets and so forth, that if you subdivide the early embryo, each part will develop into a whole individual. This is not true if you do it later. So by testing one cell of several embryos, you can find an embryo which is not going to be little a, and then you can implant it in the woman, as in vitro fertilization you always do, and you then get, hopefully, a healthy child. And both of these techniques have been widely used with considerable success. The big issue really is the condition caused by little a. If little a causes a really severe condition at a very early age, which is fatal, most people are agreed about what to do. But if little a causes some, or whatever you can detect, causes something which has a variable effect or which doesn't hit until you're 40, it's not so obvious what you should do. And these are not questions I can answer for you. I can only tell you what the technology is. So to come back to the whole issue of what's on your handout here, what we're saying is that if you do a cross between two heterozygotes and the normal allele is dominant, then in the offspring, three, on the average, three quarters will be normal and one quarter will have the mutant phenotype. Yeah, what was the question?
So do you only have alleles of genes that are non-crucial or mutations or like diseased?
Her question is, do you only have mutations in non-crucial genes? I think what she means, I'm not sure, is that what happens if you have a mutation in a critical gene? Usually that means that the embryo self-destructs. If you don't have DNA polymerase, we don't know about it, because you aren't here. If you have slightly altered DNA polymerase, we might. And the same thing, like the genes responsible for blue versus brown and orange versus black are not considered mutations. They're considered normal variants of the gene. Of course, if you're blue-eyed, you think brown is a mutation, and if you're brown, you think blue-eyed is a mutation. But the truth is, it's considered normal variation. And it doesn't. Neither one is considered mutant or altered. Yeah?
If you have two heterozygous parents and the child gets PKU, when it's in utero, what's the mechanism by which it's protected?
If you have her question is, if you have a little a child, but the parents are heterozygous, how come the child is protected in utero and you don't have to worry till the child is born? And the reason is that the child is greatly nourished by the mother's metabolism. The mother's metabolism is sufficient so that any waste products from the embryo are destroyed. The mother's enzyme, in other words, covers for the fetus's lack of enzyme. But once the child is born, they have to manage on their own. Yeah?
How does
In terms of eye color, how do the enzymes contribute to different colors like gray or green?
How come you get gray eyes, green eyes, etc.? And the answer is there are other genes coding for other pigments and other distribution of particles which affect your eye color. If you have brown pigment, from what I understand, the gene that's blue versus green doesn't show up. But if you have no brown pigment, then the gene that determines blue versus green shows up, etc. Yeah?
What about people and animals with different colored eyes?
What about people who have different colored eyes? Somebody always asks me why you have different colored eyes. There are lots of explanations for that. Some of them have to do with mosaicism of the individual, that when you had an early embryo, there was a mutation in the DNA of one of the cells, and so half the cells have one genotype and half the cells have another. Another is due to nerve damage to the eye can change color. I think that's what happened to David Bowie. And that's why he had one eye, one color, and one the other. So there are many explanations for this. Okay, so now I want to consider some of the other cases that are in your handout. Here we've assumed that the altered allele is recessive to the normal. It seems to us correct that the normal guy should always win, but this is not the case. There are many cases where, in fact, having one altered copy is sufficient to cause symptoms of a disease. That is, in the simplest case, what we're saying is that all three of these, as long as you have one A star, then you have the altered condition. In which case, instead of getting three normal to one altered, you get one normal to three altered, or a 1-to-3 ratio of normal to not. Now, in human diseases, it often happens that AA star, heterozygote, is not as sick as A star, A star. Sometimes to the extreme case where A star is lethal and AA star is only sick but walking around, to answer your question. But as long as one A star is sufficient to make you sick, people call the condition dominant. Even though these aren't exactly the same, if they both have symptoms, we say that with diseases, it's a dominant disease. Now, what is the case where one A star is sufficient to cause a human disease? Cases of that are Huntington's disease and hypercholesterolemia are the two most famous cases of that. And these are actually described in detail in your notes, so I don't think I'll go into it. What's interesting, though, is what is the mechanism? The mechanism for dominance is quite varied. And these two are very different. In that in hypercholesterolemia, you have half the usual amount of a useful good protein, which happens to be a transporter. And it turns out that this is one of those cases where having half the amount of protein is not enough. Now, this is not usually true for enzymes, but it sometimes is. It is always true, it is often true for structural proteins. Proteins, enzymes aren't the only kind of protein. Your protein also makes up many of the girders and beams that hold you up. What would you do if someone told you that half the beams in this building were defective and only half were normal? I hope you would have the sense to get out. Well, the argument here is the same, that if you inherit, say, a gene for collagen, which is one of the structural proteins, then one mutant allele and one normal, then half your collagen will be okay and half of it won't. And that often leads to deformities. Hypercholesterolemia is because a transporter that removes cholesterol from your blood is there at only half the amount. And so only half the normal amount is removed from your blood and you have high levels in the blood. And this can be treated with diet and drugs that cut down cholesterol production. Huntington's disease, on the other hand, instead of having half the good protein that you're supposed to have, you have altered protein, which I would call bad protein. So, in this case, The protein made by the altered allele actually gums up the works. It gets in the way of the effect of the other allele. Now, we're really talking here about the proteins or the products of the genes and not the genes themselves. We're saying here that half the protein made is good and half is bad. The good works and the half is ignored. But in the case of Huntington's disease, half is good and half is bad, and the bad protein interferes with the function of the good protein. To this day, no one is sure what the protein does, only that if you have half bad, you're in trouble. This is one of those conditions which can be diagnosed prenatally and pre-symptomatically, and the trouble is you don't get this condition usually till you're in your 40s, 50s, or 60s. And the question is, do you want to know that you're going to get it or not? This turns out not to be so straightforward. And if you get tested to see if you can pass it on to your children, well, then you know whether you've got it or not. So I will leave that part. And I want to say a few more things before we wrap it up today. We started a little late, so I'm going to just talk about the other cases on this handout to wrap it up. We discussed the possibility that A is dominant to A star or A star is dominant to A. Do you ever have an intermediate condition where AA star really isn't like either of the homozygous parents? And yes, there are two cases like that on your handout. One is called, case three, is called intermediate or partial dominance. They mean the same thing, or incomplete. They all mean the same thing. But the fourth case is a little different. It's called codominance. Now, these are very similar. But the slight difference is, in the case of incomplete dominance, one allele makes good protein, one allele makes altered protein, and the job gets sort of half done. And the classic example of this is red color in flowering plants. There are some plants that are red and some that have white flowers. And if you cross them, you get plants with pink flowers. Now, the idea is that the red plant makes two doses of the enzyme that catalyzes colorless to red. The white plant makes no enzyme, so it looks white. But the heterozygote makes one dose of the enzyme and makes half as much red pigment. And if you spread half as much red pigment over the same area of flower, it looks pink. Now, codominance in some ways is more interesting because in codominance, each allele does its own thing. So you make normal protein and you make altered protein, but both of them work. But each of them operates independently of the other one. And the most famous example of this is the ABO blood group. This gene codes for an enzyme that adds sugar to proteins on the surface of your red blood cells. So here you have a red blood cell, and it has protein sticking out, and you can add sugars to that red blood cell, to those proteins. And the two alleles of this gene code for different versions of the enzyme. Both versions of the enzyme are active, but they're slightly different. So their active site is slightly different, so the sugar they bind is different. So one of them adds galactose, and the other one adds N-acetylgalactosamine. Now, the one that adds galactose is called IB. The phenotype is blood type B, but the genotype or the allele is IB. And the one that adds N-acetylglutosamine is called A. So if you're homozygous IB, you have galactose on all your red blood cells. If you're homozygous AIA, you have N-acetylgalactosamine on all your red blood cells. But what happens if you're a heterozygote? You have both. Sometimes this enzyme gets there first, and sometimes the enzyme that adds this gets there first. So every individual blood, red blood cell has some galactose on it and some N-acetylgalactosamine. Now, one of the reasons for bringing this up is you all know there are three, there are actually four blood types. There's A, B, O, and AB. A is only this allele. That's one possibility. B is only this allele. What's O? And we know what AB is. AB is a heterozygote. But what's O? It's actually a third allele of this gene, which is written as little I to indicate that it is recessive to the two codominant alleles. Little I codes for inactive enzyme. So if you're homozygous I, you don't add any sugar at all. Now, how many ways can you be blood type B? It turns out there are two, because you can be homozygous IB, or you can be IB little I, and you'll still be blood type B. You can be IA little I, or homozygous IA, and you can still be blood type A. But there's only one way to be AB, and there's only one way to be O. And this turns out to be important in blood transfusions, because you have to add nothing new. You don't have to match exactly the donor and the recipient. You just have to be sure you don't add anything new. Because if you add anything new, it's perceived as foreign and you run into an antibody problem. And so all of the permutations and combinations are written both in your book and in your notes. Now, what we'll do next time is we'll think, how do you analyze these crosses with people? You cannot say to people, in the interest of science, would you please get on with a mating and have a lot of offspring. Obviously, you have to go about it in some other way. And we'll talk about that next time.